Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Ethan. I don't know, is this an upgrade or a downgrade?
With me showing up instead of Tom, it's a downgrade, my friend. I'm sorry. You dug around in the gutter. There I was. You picked me up and put me on a mic. Here I am.
I just don't know that I believe you with that one, Ethan. Is it really windy and cold up there right now?
Oh yeah, yeah. Up here being almost Canada, way up in northern New Hampshire, where I live in the mountains. And yeah. It is frigid. It is single digits Fahrenheit below zero Celsius. And it's not too windy today, but yeah, we had a lot of snowfall, and it's every bit of winter is finally here.
Yeah, well, we have the same thing here in Tennessee. I have been filling the bird feeder every other day or so because the birds are basically relying entirely on the bird feeder to survive the winter, which is really crazy. I go out there and I'm like, holy mackerel, I have like 2 16-inch bird feeders and they're empty every other day. Like, what is going on here?
You sure you don't have a bear?
Well, we could. In my backyard, we could, but okay. And today we are joined by Daniel. All right, Daniel, you're going to have to help me.
Techney,
thanks.
Daniel Techney, yep.
It sounds easier than it. And where are you, Daniel?
I live in a coastal town in Victoria in Australia called Ocean Grove, about 10,000 people. So it's
sounds lovely.
Not too warm today. I'm still waiting for summer, and we're almost halfway through our summer. But yeah, it's a pretty nice place to live, to be honest.
Yeah. The times I've been in Australia, I've loved it. It's a great place, hanging out with the snakes and the spiders and the
the wiggly sticks.
Koalas, which are actually really cool, the koalas. Although I've heard you have to be very careful about the jumpy things, the kangaroos.
The jump beds.
Yeah.
Oh, the kangaroos.
Yeah, kangaroos. I've heard they're actually not as sweet as they look in the films.
Yeah, they're not. If you see them out in the wild, best to just give them a wide berth, to be honest.
They're pretty mean from what I hear, if you get up too close.
Pretty much anything in Australia will either bite or kill you. It's some type. It's a pretty hostile fauna by default, to be honest.
Does it make you glad you live in New Hampshire there?
I'm happy up here. We have different things that'll kill you, but not kangaroos.
So not that's kangaroos, yeah. So today we're talking about automation. It's a perennial topic because it's an important topic. I don't know that you can ever say enough about automation unless you just automate the podcast on it. I don't know. Where you just set up ChatGPT to do a continuous show about automation, and it would go for like 10 years and it probably would never repeat itself. I don't know. It just seems like a thing. But anyway. So, Daniel, you had a different take on this, which was we were going to start more from the idea of culture and preparing things, right? Rather than the idea of tools and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, obviously, a lot of the talk about network automation, you know, if you think of any system, you have people, processes, and tools. And there's a lot of content and discussion driven around tools, you know, choosing this tool over this tool. And in regards to people, there's a lot of training and awareness around, you know, getting people up to speed with the tools that are out there, and, you know, essentially elevating the default literacy level, I guess, of people with automation. But there isn't really that much talk around the process or the cultural adoption of automation. And so that's what I'd like to talk about today, because okay, what I find is that, you know, like everyone has their own personal tool preferences, or, you know, we can debate about how well, you know, we can debate about basically whether we need network engineers to, you know, give up the CLI and adopt automation, or you know, whether people starting out in their career should develop automation skills first and then networking skills first. All that stuff's important, but there are other people talking about those topics, and I don't feel that there's many people talking about, you know, the process and how to get automation, how to actually get traction with automation within a business, and ultimately get adoption and get usage and get buy-in, because that is really what I see holds a lot of companies back.
So when you talk about the process, you talk about the you're talking about, we don't have automation today. We want to have an automated network when it's all said and done, and the process of getting there?
I mean, a few things, to be honest, Ethan. So first thing is literally the individual, you know, what I call workflows or processes that a company currently manually does today. So, you know, you walk into any environment, any small environment, all the way up to the mega environments of the world, there are repeatable tasks that the people are manually doing today. You know, whether that be configuration backups, you know, VLAN changes, routing changes, compliance reports, whatever it is, there are, you know, that nearly every single company has repeated work. And so I'm talking about, you know, getting those things actually agreed upon and documented. And then I'm also talking about the second issue, which is the process of actually going from nothing to, you know, actually using automation and using that as a virtuous cycle to drive more efficiencies. So if I talk about initially about, you know, the individual processes, we really need to sort of just take a higher level approach to the whole thing and just think about, you know, what is documentation in the overall scheme of activities that you do within a company. So I've sort of been thinking about this for a while, and I think the best way that I can describe it is each organization has what I would call like an activity bias. So if you think of it like a scale, you know, some companies are right over on the proactive side, and, you know, by default, they're proactive in everything that they do. Then you have other companies that, you know, are more reactive in what they do. So documentation as an activity is a proactive activity. So what does that mean? That means that we, or the people that are documenting, are saying this knowledge is valuable and it'll be needed again. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to take a proactive mindset and I'm going to invest some time and resources to save my future self or my future colleague from rediscovering this knowledge from scratch. And so if you value documentation and you have correct documentation, then you're making a proactive intent that you plan to recoup later on. But like anything in life, you know, we're all humans and we're all social creatures, and ultimately we're going to do whatever the tribe rewards, and we're going to do less of what the tribe doesn't reward. So if you think about like at a company level, if the company doesn't value proactivity or that sort of work, then naturally teams or individuals are going to adapt to what a company actually rewards. So I feel like that's a really big thing. And you can generally sort of understand when you go into any organization, what sort of is their default activity bias.
So documentation of processes is a... Dude, that's a body of knowledge that you have to maintain if you build that out. Now, so there's some context here. If I'm a proactive organization and I document things, including processes, good. Not all shops do this, especially depending on how folks are staffed and what the complexity of those processes might be and how much they change. But from an automation perspective, I can't automate what I don't understand. And so I do see it's a necessary step to automate something to understand in intimate detail exactly what's going on, especially when you're touching multiple systems and so on. Creating a VLAN isn't simply going into the VLAN database on a switch and creating a VLAN. It touches a lot of things, and a lot of external processes get impacted there. And so documenting that in detail so that you can automate it is a necessary preparation step. So are you saying I have to be a proactive organization that does documentation ahead of time, or I'm going to struggle with automation? Or are you saying if I'm not a proactive organization,
I need to be more proactive.
I need, yeah.
So there's a bit of both, right? So obviously you have a big organization, and then within every organization, there's like sub teams and teams, right? So what I'm trying to say is automation. So you've got documentation, you know, that's a pretty proactive thing to do, but automation is an even further down the proactivity scale, because what we're actually saying there is we've identified a recurring expenditure of time, resources, money. We're going to commit an investment to save on that repeated effort each time in the future. So if we're trying to automate something, but the company or the sub team that we work in doesn't even value documentation or doesn't want to document for whatever reasons, which I'll get into, we're taking a quite a large, you know, activity or leap. So what we actually need to do is actually just understand what the appetite or what the conditions are that we're working in, and then that way we can, you know, help people move towards further and further to being more proactive. So in the context of like a, you know, if you take like a emergency department, right, you know, by default, that's a reactive organization. You know, we're responding to true emergencies. But even inside that sort of environment, you know, they still take proactive steps. Like they make sure they've got enough bandages, enough bed, a clean beds, enough needles, you know, systems in place so that when a reactive event occurs, you can still be proactive and reactive at the same time. So I'm not saying you need to be one or the other, but it's just, I'm just trying to acknowledge that this is one of the issues for automation is sometimes it's, you know, it's towards the end of the, you know, closer out to being fully proactive. And sometimes it doesn't work because the current environment isn't set up for that.
So I would actually go further with your proactive and reactive and say many organizations are reactive in the sense that they will only do things that they find will bring them money through the door. They don't do infrastructure stuff. They, you know, so you find yourself constantly trying to find a way to push automation or whatever the project is from a technology perspective, strictly based on I can offer a new product by doing this, and never on the perspective of it's going to save me money, or never on the perspective of it's going to make the network better in the long term. Because saving money and making the network better are really non-issues for a lot of organizations. It's much more about, particularly in the service provider space, it's much more about what new product am I going to offer? Bring me a product to the table that you're going to give me because of automation. And so that's also a proactive-reactive differential in stance to me.
Yeah, I feel like there's a few things, and I agree with you there. But that's, I guess, from a business's level, a chronic misunderstanding of what a shared service is. So back to your analogy, like, you know, I joke that, you know, network engineers are essentially digital plumbers, right? You know, we flow stuff from place to place, and no one cares until the toilets all back up and overflow, right? No one actually cares.
When it gets stinky, people care.
Until the problem is truly catastrophic. Right. So that, I agree, like no one cares about the network until it stops working. So that, it's hard for us to sort of influence that, but that's a, I guess, a chronic misunderstanding at a macro level of what an actual shared service is, which is what the network is. But
Well, the answer from a networking perspective for me is to always find a way to tie what I'm working on to revenue, right? Is not to be a plumber all the time. I mean, there is a bit of networking that's plumbing, but there's a bit of networking that is not plumbing. Like, okay, even if I were a plumber and somebody said to me, well, I don't really care if there are bathrooms in the front end of my, they're accessible by my customers, because they don't pay me for those bathrooms, right? But if I can somehow say, yeah, but nobody's going to show up at your door and actually walk into your place of business. Or if they have to go to the bathroom, they have to wash their hands or whatever they have to do, they have to walk out of your business to do it, they ain't coming back. So you're going to lose business. I need to tie this to revenue. How do I tie it to revenue? That's a proactive stance that you can take as well. I don't know. Ethan's over there with a... He's thinking.
No, the proactive versus reactive conversation in this context, Russ, where you're trying to justify to a business stakeholder why they should undertake an automation initiative, belies, if you have to convince them of that, then the value of the network within the organization is in question. You probably don't have to have that argument in a service provider as much because the network is the product. Anything you're doing that enables them to deliver services more quickly and more robustly is something they can make money on. That's an easy equation to make. If I'm a large enterprise, automation maybe is fuzzier what the benefits are that it brings. And so you need to be able to explain automation in that context. So, I mean, I put the burden back on the engineering community to explain to a business stakeholder why automation matters. And it's not just to make my life easier as an engineer. Yeah. It's talk about things like repeatability, reducing errors and downtime in the network, these sorts of things that I don't know, you can map some to proactive and some to reactive, but it feels like that's a conversation you should have already been having right along with your business where they understand the value of IT. And if they're still looking at IT as an expense center, there's a lot of groundwork you got to do to have a better conversation.
Yeah, around automation. Yeah.
But yeah, if we, accept that, that they're happy that they want to spend time and resources on networking, the next sort of, main barrier is assisting these network teams in taking whatever tribal knowledge that they have, whether that's documented or not, and getting it into a form that at least, gives automation people a high level, recipe or workflow as to what we're actually doing. So like, what do I mean by that? Most network automation, practitioners, they can deploy a VLAN to an access port, right? No problem, they could do that. But they can't deploy a VLAN to your switch using your business processes. So what pre and post change checks do you need to do? What do you mark as done? What notifications do you need? What approvals do you need? In some financial institutions, you can't even change an access VLAN on a port without getting approvals in triplicate. In other places, Bob or Wendy is just, jumping on the CLI and, changing the port. So as automation practitioners, we need assistance from those teams that manage the overall business context and process. We need to extract that out of them into some sort of document or some sort of workflow so that we can take that and we can agree together. This is what we've agreed is what you currently manually do. And we will take that and we will automate either the entire process or subcomponents. Because as much as network automation practitioners, are invested in automation and think it's the future, we're also not naive to think that we shouldn't be automating absolutely everything. Like, we need to be pragmatic. There are some steps that whilst we could automate that particular component of the solution, it needs to make business sense. There's no point sometimes automating some subcomponents of the process, or maybe we automate some of it. We retrieve those savings and then we take that time and we reinvest into automating more of the sub-steps, the components. And what are some of the tools that I'm talking about to capture this workflow? It can be something as simple as, literally just writing out dot points and adding in the decision trees, like add VLAN to switch port. And then, the next step might be check that, that the VLAN is present on the port. If it's present on the port, proceed to the next step. If it's not present, send a report to someone. And so there's, you could just start from a text document, or you could use things like there are markdown based visual tools that you can document your process in. So something like Mermaid.js. So it's just markdown and you can actually draw diagrams from text and then you can visualize the process with those networking teams and the automation teams. And we can see visually what's going to occur. If we go down the yes decision tree where everything goes right, we can see how that works. when something fails, we can see what happens on the failure tree. And so just starting to start out from really simple tools like that. We don't really need to use things like Visio. We don't need to write massive Microsoft Word documents, because ultimately we just need accurate information. The formatting is a secondary concern. And a lot of engineers get caught up in it needs to be perfectly aligned and in 6-point bold. Like, yeah, that's great, but we need to just get the documentation captured. And then once that's sort of agreed, the automation people can go off and automate what is agreed. Because that brings me around to another point, which is...
Well, hang on a second, Daniel, because what you just described was a fairly robust, mature feeling process. That is, I'm not starting there with automation typically. If I'm getting started with automation as an engineer, I'm fiddling with a Python script or some Ansible to do some technical thing very focused on the engineering side. And what you're describing is like, okay, it's time to get serious about this. I can't be running these scripts off my laptop by myself. We need to make this a repeatable process that everybody in the organization can use. Let's get serious now, especially going to be true with the larger organizations like you're talking about, where there's hierarchies, different groups that are interacting, and so on. So I feel like if you force everybody into the box, the automation box, where it's like, you got to document everything, it's got to be not just the technical processes, but all the other systems and organizations within the company that might be affected by this automation or touched in some way, it gets to feel like you're never going to get started.
I think my experience with this has been is you're almost better off to start off with something even easier than Markdown, which is like a wiki. And just have people have wikis where they just throw notes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, we just need automation, we need a document.
Yeah, throw your notes in this wiki. I don't care how it's organized right now. Just throw these notes in the wiki. And a piece of this that I think people miss is not just what they're doing in a process perspective, but also troubleshooting, anticipated troubleshooting. If this fails, where do I expect the knock to go look? Where are the points where there are weaknesses that I anticipate failure? Because we often do a very good job if we document, we do a good job of documenting process in network diagrams, particularly at the physical layer. The things I've discovered over time is we suck at doing layer 3 network diagrams. We're totally horrible at logical network diagrams, and we're totally horrible at documenting where we think things are going to break. And it seems like to me those seem to be, even from an automation perspective, if I'm writing this script, I would say, all right, if that file doesn't exist, I kind of expect it to do this. That error message kind of means that to me. I don't know. Maybe that's pushing too much. Maybe Ethan will push back and say, you're still going too far.
Just to clarify on Ethan's point, what I was trying to say is we actually need the current manual process documented, right? Yep. And then we need to abstract the process from the implementation. So sort of addressing your point there.
Yeah.
The network team doesn't care whether we use Ansible, Python, Terraform, Pigeon language. They don't care, right? They need to mutually agree. This is our current manual process. We document that, and then we abstract the implementation details from them. That shouldn't be their concern. What should be their concern is keeping the process documented and up to date so that if we manually do it or we do it via automation, we're all working from the same playbook.
I'm just thinking about the reality of shops where I've worked and the way
documentation goes down. Is that real? I don't know.
That's why I brought up that proactive versus reactive conversation at the start and the organizational activity bias and what behaviors are rewarded, right? Because if a company chronically under-resources their networking team, and then naturally, as any human in life, when you're under-resourced, you are going straight back to reactive. You are literally triaging things by who yells the most, right?
You don't have a choice.
You're absolutely not investing any time in doing layer 3 diagrams, as-builts, architectural decision registers. You're not doing any of that stuff. So that was why I wanted to bring that up at the start about that's where some of the issues actually are. And downstream, those manual implementers or the automated implementers, you know, we're not really in fertile conditions to actually succeed if that's the case up the chain.
Yeah. So going beyond this, so your thought is you have to document the way things are, which I'm not sure a lot of people can document much more than a few basic processes in their networks.
And that's fine though. Like, yeah. Let's just start the top three. Let's actually start to reward a culture of, all right, how do we actually change an access VLAN? Like, let's all just write this down. Like, we all know how to do this as CCNA, CCNP engineers. We know how to do this like the back of our hand. Let's actually document this down. And let's get that off our plate. So that'll actually encourage a couple of things. One, it'll encourage the network team to value, if I write something down, then the automation team take that off my plate. So now that invent back to that behavioral change, it's rewarding them. If I document things, the automation team will automate away that problem. So now we're starting to set up a virtuous cycle of, if I document things, the reward to me, the personal reward to me and the company reward is I don't end up having to manage that problem anymore. And so when we start out with just the top three processes, we start to build that circle of trust. But because the networking engineers, you know, they don't trust the automation, right? They by default, and I empathize with them. I wouldn't trust it either. So they need to see value. So if we just start doing the top 3 to 5 read-only processes even, you know, then we can build a culture of trust. We can build a culture of, you know, they're getting a return on their investment. The higher level business managers can see the benefit, and then we can increment from there. But instead, what I see is we try and go, you know, we try and throw the proverbial Hail Mary and start out with a multi-business, like a multi-business unit process. Like, for example, when I spin up, you know, I'm a server admin and I spin up a VM, I want to make sure that it automatically gets added to, you know, an F5 pool and, you know, auto registers in a pool. And like we try and take on too much. Let's not do that. Let's just start out with the basics of the basics, the stuff that happens within the networking team. Let's iterate over that and prove value and go from there.
So here's a product idea for anybody who's listening out there who has control over these things, which is that I feel like when you go, or I think that when you go and you start looking at documenting something you've done or you are doing, you first of all, you mess up your flow. It's like when you're writing a book or whatever. If you spend too much time on your outline, you mess up your flow. And you have to like just let the text come and organize it as needed later if you're going to get the writing done. A lot of times, I know Ethan's over there going, "Oh, that's the answer! Get it now!" Because that's really the way I write. I just go, right? I don't really think about, "Oh, the outline said this." It's like whatever just fits in that text or whatever, and then later on you can go back and reorganize it. And I think that when we are doing a network task like building a new VLAN for the book, we probably tend to overthink it. We probably tend to go, is that really what I should be doing? I don't know. Do I want to write it down that way? So some sort of a system that would record that over multiple iterations and figure out the common patterns and self-document based on what you're doing rather than you having to write down what you're doing would be an awful nice thing as a beginning phase of automation. I don't know of anything that does that. That's why I bring that up.
For sure. Know. Yeah, like it would be awesome if we documented by osmosis or by observation, you know, literally like a tool that shoulder surfed and watched everything that you did on the screen and could somehow automatically make a document. But
yeah, nothing exists like that today. So
yeah, I mean, I'd be probably.
Well, back in the days of expert systems, that's what they did, right? You hired somebody to stand there and do nothing but the doctor does this first. And 9 times out of 10, the doctor does this first. So therefore, doctors should be doing that first. Physicians, whatever it is, kind of a thing. We don't have that today, unfortunately. So sorry for the rabbit trail. That's just like a something that occurs to me as I'm listening to this go through.
Yeah.
So, Dana, did you make all your points about that first part of this conversation, documenting and how to document and how to get there and so on, and the necessity of it for automation? The next part of the conversation being actually moving our processes to using automation, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously, once we have that agreed artifact, I'll just use the word artifact as it can come in any form. Once we have that agreed document, then the automation team can start to look at the individual components and use their skills to determine, you know, how we should do this particular step, what tool we should use, so on and so forth. So, you know, speaking of which, you know, there's a lot of conversations around, you know, the vendors should standardize and provide us, you know, this interface or that interface, or they should provide these tools or whatever. And for me, I feel like there's a few things that need to be added to that conversation. Firstly, like vendors, like if I'm just being really honest, as a vendor, why would I want to provide the exact same product as my competitor? Because if I did, it'd be a zero-sum game on price. So then they're not actually incentivized to provide a fully interoperable, fully standardized solution, because if they did, it'd be a race to zero on price. So I think we just, as an industry, need to maybe not really go down that path of being idealistic, because really, you know, whilst we're their customers and we pay their bills, really they're acting in their own interest. And I completely get that. They've got shareholders to fulfill and profits to make. So, you know, like, and just to sort of drill into that example, take something like a bicycle, right? The bicycle was invented in 1818. That's 206 years old. You know, it's been around a lot longer than networking. And there is even less standardization now than there was back then. You know, you think about, there's like numerous different wheel sizes on a bike, different seat types, saddle types, handlebar types, attachments.
I built a bike from scratch, everything but the frame. So starting with the frame, just to find the components that would fit and all the different choices of things that could have been, depending on what frame I had selected, were myriad. It was incredible. Very tedious process to find parts that would build that bike.
Yeah. And so if you use the analogy of the bike, you know, it's really, like, if we be really honest, the absolute minimum is standardized to the point where customers will accept it. So they literally drive you out to what will you actually accept as the minimum, and everything else is differentiated so that they can compete. And ultimately make profit. And, you know, like I've worked with many salespeople over the years, and one of them used to always sell to me, I don't sell the price, I sell the value, right? So so that's their mindset. You know, they're not here to say our thing is $8.99 and our vendors is $9.99. They're selling you the value, because that's how they make their money. So if we sort of take that back to automation, you know, there's enough options in the market to put your components together to fulfill your needs. Some of them are great, some of them are not so great. You know, there's also consulting companies that have, you know, automation consultant companies that have now entered the market that can help you should you need it. But like, I don't really think that we should be expecting the proverbial silver bullet from all these vendors, because they're not incentivized to do so. So,
well, how do you mean silver bullet from them? Like an automation solution that would... So one of the conversations we've had around automation is there's no standard data model. Everybody's data model from all the vendors is different. Yeah, we've got some commonalities like OpenConfig. We've got some Yang models that we can work with as an industry that are standard more or less. But generally speaking, the data models differ wildly vendor to vendor. And there's a complaint among folks that are into automation and of multi-vendor networks. I want a standard data model, so I don't have to build a whole new bit of code to ask a different device the same question.
Is that the thing
you're getting at, or it sounds like you're talking more broadly than just that, I guess, Daniel.
Yeah, but even just that example, right? Why would vendor A provide the same data model as vendor B, right? They're going to provide you the data model to drive their platform, right?
Yeah.
They don't care about,
I don't disagree with you.
They don't care about providing you a utopian data model that's going to drive their competitors' platform, because, I mean, that's the surest way to put themselves out of business. They're not going to do
guess,
that.
So I guess the major, yeah, I guess the major pushback on that would be there are some things that are standard across assigning an IP address to an interface. There's no competitive value in doing that, right? So why can't we standardize on those things and then have other parts of the model? Now, To some degree, we
tried
to do that.
Because MIB2 and Enterprise Private MIBs, that's why.
Yes, exactly. Because we tried this, and it didn't get us anywhere. So, I don't know.
I feel like the only thing that we should really be imploring our vendors to do, and it pains me to say this, like, because it's 2024, is, like, they need to have API feature parity solutions. So anything that you can do through the CLI must be able to be done through the API. That's what we should be pushing. Everything else is like, we'll just take it from here, because they're not, you know, that back to that bike analogy, like that's the absolute bare minimum that we should be expecting. And we don't even get that now, right? So that's something that they should be delivering. And then everything else is just down to what's your opinions, what's your preferences, what's your likes, what's your dislikes. So that's what I feel.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. So let's go continue from that, though, right? The next step is to say we want to implement this now. So what are the cultural and process things that are there that you've seen?
Yeah. So in almost, you know, and speaking to colleagues and other automation folk in the industry, you know, and you both probably would have experienced this, Ethan, you probably experienced it in your consulting career. You know, when you always go into a new environment, there's the vocal dissenter. We all know who that personality type is when we enter an environment. And that person holds a lot of influence or sway within an organization. And they're the people that you ultimately need to win over, but how do you win them over? Like, that's probably one of the main issues. And so there's a few approaches. Obviously, you win them over directly, like you alleviate their concerns, or you address their concerns, or you take things off their plate and assist them, or you work with their manager, and their manager by extension tells them, you know, this is the new future you need to get on board.
So you mean threaten?
hey, don't threaten anyone.
No. You'll find one of those famous snakes from the Australian outback and say,
yeah,
this is going to be your Christmas present if you don't get on board.
Send them a gif of a brown steak or something and say, this is coming for you. No, if we don't do anything like that. So there's always that vocal dissenter. So really, we just need to go into the environment and just have more of an open conversation or dialogue about what their current pain points are. So back to those top to three to five documented processes, what their current pain points are. They're probably going to be higher end complex issues. Let's not start out with that. Let's just start out with the basics. You know, ideally read only processes would be best. And let's build trust. Let's get those things off their plate, and let's remove some of those non-differentiated tasks that they have to do. And once we can show them the value to them, they tend to, you know, dial down the dissension to a point where it's actually a somewhat harmonious working environment. But but generally, that's generally the main issue that I see. And yeah, it's obviously difficult, because these aren't going to be skills on automation exams, right? Like, no one's going to be teaching you this stuff. And these skills come about from, you know, working in consulting in general, or working across multiple environments, or just, you know, next time you go to your local sporting club or your local church or local organization, right? You know, these personality types, they pop up in various organizations. So when I use the term organization, we're talking about companies, but, you know, there's many organizations. Within your family, there's probably vocal dissenters or people who say you can't do this and do that. So just understanding how to read and empathize and understand with people and adapt your behavior accordingly.
Yeah, the thing you said about consultants having faced this. Yeah, every consulting engagement I did back when I was consulting was very much that. I was brought in to bring about some sort of significant change within the organization, and my last step when the project was done was training the full-time IT staff that supported that environment on everything that was going on. And man, it was everything from we love this and we're happy to I hate everything you are because of what you represent, as if the consultant came in and so therefore that must mean the business thinks we're terrible and we're no good at our jobs, and so they brought you in and I hate you for it. and trying to get those people on your side who were dissenting the changes that you brought about and whatever the technology was that you were introducing could be a tough thing. Having sympathy, having empathy, understanding where they're coming from, getting them on your side, realizing I'm your friend here. You know, I was hired to do this. And honestly, this is a better thing. And let me show you. I know you. This is what you guys were doing before. And we've moved it to this now. I know you're not familiar with it, but trust me, this is better. Let me show you. I'm here to teach you anything you want to know. Let's spend some time together and get them to buy into that, oh, they're really on my side. They got nothing against me. They actually think I'm a pretty good engineer. Then you can make some strides that way. But that there's still gonna, I think the classic dissenter that comes up in these conversations is the older engineer with gray in their beard who doesn't want to change. And I built this thing 30 years ago and I don't want to automate anything because I know all the commands and now you're taking all the stuff I know and taking it away from me. Those people feel threatened. I don't know if you've run into that, Daniel, particularly, but I know that's a tough one, especially to work through.
Well, yeah, like pretty much happened in most places. But again, I try and take the macro conditions at play. So, you know, that person has a manager, and that manager, you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, hasn't addressed that problem for some time. So to think that I'm going to come in, you know, fly in on my API supported high horse and come in and fix all that's, you know, not really going to happen. So those people are allowed to exist and to some extent thrive through, you know, companies not actually managing risk well or properly, which is we have this network guru, you know, Terry or Jane, they're the network guru. And, you know, every time I hear that someone's a guru, like it sends a cold shiver down my spine every time because I'm like, here we go. This is going to be fun. But
Brent,
you know, like
from the Phoenix Project.
Brent, yeah. So, you know, those people exist because of the conditions and also the behaviors that are rewarded or not rewarded. So we just need to, you know, not instead of like struggling against it and being like, I can't believe it, this is, you know, I have to talk to Brent every single time to get the most trivial detail out. Why doesn't he put it on the wiki? Like, let's just accept that is reality and let's just try and work with them and try and understand their concerns. And, you know, instead of being adversarial, try and be collegial in terms of the way that you go with these people. But ultimately, those people have to relinquish control or, you know, undertake some sort of aha moment to actually appreciate automation. So that's where some of the skills lie in terms of you really need to understand and read people and understand their concerns and fears so that you can address them so that they end up, you know, I've worked in a lot of places where I start out with someone like that. And after speaking to them for a while, I actually understand they probably actually are for automation, but they've had a traumatic experience in the past where someone put a Cisco EEM script on the network and bricked the network at 4 o'clock in the morning and they had to come in and they're just like, never, no automation again. So sometimes digging a little bit deeper helps out.
It could be the reason you're there as a consultant, let's say, is for political reasons, you know, corporate politics and put you on site. They're caught in the crossfire and just resent the whole situation they find themselves in because it feels like they're being tied up in a bunch of busy work they don't want to be a part of. And they're just bitter about the whole thing. And it doesn't have a lot to do with you. It's just that their irritation with the situation falls upon you. And if you can be a sympathetic ear, you can turn that thing around and try to make them your friend, improve the situation big time.
So going beyond these culture things, are there other culture things that people who are working on automation need to think about or to figure out before they dive into this that would be helpful?
Yeah, so there's a lot of a lot of network automation is, you know, network automation is sort of, you know, latent in the overall field of automation, right? So server automation is a lot more mature. Cloud automation is a lot more mature. Security or some aspects of security automation is a lot more mature. And so as a result, you know, we're looking towards them for some sort of guidance or, you know, they probably come across some of these problems before. So, you know, reading books like the Phoenix Project or the SQL, you know, just having an actual understanding of agile processes and some of the terminology and language, I find that sort of stuff helps. Secondly, we don't, you know, automation isn't special. Like nothing that an automation person does is, you know, magic. It literally is you write an instruction and a computer computes the instruction. So we don't really, like, there isn't anything special happening here. Sure, you need to learn the tools, but it really isn't that special. So why do I say that? It means that, like, if we are adopting automation, we shouldn't introduce single points of failure, you know, whether that be people or tools. So we need to make sure that we don't propagate and become the automation brand. So making sure you set up a culture of, you know, there's not always one person that's relied upon, and setting up a culture of learning and continuous improvement and looking at other verticals or similar verticals for some inspiration. I find that that helps as well. So for myself, I would listen to other podcasts. You know, I listen to Python language podcasts, right? Because that's the primary language that I use, but I'm also learning just generally about that. And I've heard you talk about this before, Russ, but, you know, you've got your specialization, and if you can learn sort of either side of that, that makes you more effective as well.
Yeah. 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 Innovation happens at the intersections. It never happens by going deeper and deeper and deeper. It always happens at the intersections in my experience. So, yeah. So, okay. So we are at 46 minutes. We probably need to wrap up. So I want to make sure we didn't have anything else that you wanted to cover, Daniel, before we, like, mute your mic and say goodbye to you in absentia.
No, that's it for me. Yeah. Thanks again letting me come on here. And it's good to talk to you both again. And
Can people get in touch with you someplace or follow your work? You have blog someplace, or you don't have a corner section of Packet Pushers, do you, or something where you blog?
No, I have my own blog. So it's blog.danielteschny.com.
Okay.
And I went off the blog for a while, having a new baby, moving house, moving city, you know, that sort of put the kibosh to that for a while.
Yep.
But yeah, back on the blog, I'm talking more probably at these sort of philosophical or high level concepts, and occasionally I might dive into technical detail, but at the moment that stuff interests me, or I feel more passionate about writing about those subjects. So you can reach me on there. I'm also on LinkedIn, and I'm on X. If you send me a message on there, I'll reply to you, but generally pretty sparse interactions on those platforms.
Okay, cool. Well, Ethan, I'm not even going to ask you, because everyone knows how to get to Ethan. Ethan is famous and so easy.
Yeah, I wish. Yeah, it is easy to forget a hold of me. You can do that in a couple of ways. One is LinkedIn. I'm happy to connect with you, and you can follow me over there. I write techie nerd stuff for people that are trying to keep up with the IT industry, especially networking. And then packetpushers.net. That's what Russ is getting at if you've never heard my name before, because we got a podcast over there. Several podcasts, actually, all aimed at IT.
Several dozen podcasts.
Not dozen. We've got 7, and we're launching 3 more over the next few months.
We're a growing thing.
It's happening. Yeah, okay, it's happening. Good. Packetpushers.net, everybody.
Awesome. And I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at The Hedge on Rule11.tech on LinkedIn. And I have been logging into Twitter X every now and again, but it's not my, you know, like Daniel said, those aren't my interaction platforms. You're better off to find my email address or something like that. And if you don't know it, you can always ask Ethan. And Ethan's easy to find.
I have multiple emails for Russ.
So, we value your attention. We know that we live in an attention economy, and that your time spent with us is really important. So thank you for listening, and thank you for paying attention to The Hedge. We hope you find this content useful. And again, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service, or follow along at rule11.tech.